Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's good to see each one of you, and certainly we're glad to have Joyce out this morning.
Amen.
Been a few rough days, but the Lord has renewed our strength to be out with us today, and we're happy that she's here. We're going to talk something about prison subcultures, and then we're going to do how-tos. Now, if you have any questions while we're going along, please feel free to ask questions. And I always say that there's not but one question that's probably a dumb question, and that's the one you don't ask because you can't get an answer. So I want you to just feel free to ask whatever's on your mind. Okay, prison subcultures is a very interesting subject. From the standpoint that all prisons are different. Our prisons in the United States are actually different from your prisons here in Canada. Your prison in Edmonton will be different, have a different personality than the prison in Toronto or Montreal. In the States, we can have five prisons in one city. And in fact, in Nashville, we have about five or six prisons in Nashville. And each one of those prisons have a different personality. So all prisons usually have the rules that govern them from the state or the province, and then they have internal rules. They call them in-house rules. That governs the operation of that prison. So I usually approach it from the fact that can these bones live? And this is a question that Ezekiel is asking. And when you think about guys who are locked up in prison, that question is a relevant question. Can these bones live? When men have gone through so much, and sometimes you might think that these guys are the worst examples of humanity, and there is no hope for them. But Isaiah, when he was asking the question, can these bones live, he got an answer back from the master teacher. Who told him what he needed to do. So when one contemplates the level of degradation that exists in prisons and visualize men who have succumbed to the lower stages of human existence, caged up like animals, ostracized by society, treated like a leper, and labeled, labeled as the lowest of the lowest by social standards, seeing such an abysmal pronouncement imposed upon this segment of society, the clarion call of Ezekiel becomes increasingly imminent. Son of man, can these bones live? Ezekiel said that the hand of the Lord was upon me and carried me out in the spirit of the Lord and set me down in the midst of the valley, which was full of bones, and caused me to pass by them around about, and behold, they were very many in the open valley, and lo, they were very dry. And he said unto me, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered, O Lord God, thou knowest. Again he said unto me, prophesy upon these bones, hear the voice of the Lord. In prison, there are some real dry bones that need to experience the love of God. And I have to be careful that we don't say that they need to be preached to, because then we become judgmental. So They need to experience the love of God, and that experience comes through us not only prophesying, but we are sharing the love of God to them. And so that's how our prophesying come in. Then we began, when they began to hear the word of God, and these bones that have been so dead, dry, that they rattled, now they began to come together. And then flesh began to come on these bones, and when the flesh comes on, it's just God's spirit working, and so that now these bones that were dead spiritually have come alive because of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Amen. This valley of dry bones that propelled Ezekiel to ask such an explosive question, "Son of man, can these bones live?" is a prevalent question that we ask the Department of Correction Facilities. Can these bones live? Now, as far as the Department of Correction is concerned, they probably don't care whether they live or not, because rehabilitation is not on their agenda. And security is on their agenda. I remember once that a warden told me that he would much rather have extra security officers than have a chaplain at the institution. And he didn't know that the only reason that things are not worse than they were was because of the constraints of God. And because there were religious people coming in, working with the inmates, and there were chaplains who could deal with the spiritual things that inmates are going through, the griefs, the deaths, the marriages, and all those things, family situations. And not realizing that chaplains are so vital in keeping down a whole lot of confusion among inmates in prisons. And so inmates love to have chaplains that they can go to and talk to. Prisons are made up of subcultures of dry bones that need to be revitalized by the power of God. Now, what are prisons and prison subcultures? Number one, prisons are social tools of control. So they don't know how to deal with personalities and the things that men go through with. So the only way that we can control them is that we build walls and we cage them up. And we keep them behind the walls. And so it becomes a control mechanism more than a saving mechanism. The only thing that they figure that they save is that they save society from some of the turmoil that might come from these individuals that are locked up. Warehouses where prisons are, and as I told you yesterday, I think I mentioned that prisons are economic forms of slavery, where they warehouse men and just keep them. And if you warehouse someone and you don't do anything to provide guidance and rehabilitation and the introduction of Christ in their life and the changing of the way that they think and the way that they act, then when they leave the prison, they will act just like they did when they first, before they came in. So that's why we have so much recidivism, is because nothing has been ingrained in the personality of that individual that will help them to change and to live a different kind of life. And so that's why what we do as volunteers is so important. The prison doesn't really have the staff to do what we do. So here, I guess you be more in the role of volunteers in the States. They become more as unpaid staff. Because once they come behind the wall, then the state is liable for anything that happened to the volunteer. And which is a good thing. And as long as the volunteer doesn't roam and wander around and do something that they shouldn't be doing, then the state is liable for them. But if you exceed the rim of liability, then you're pretty much on your own. There are big businesses in the U.S. It costs over $50 billion to run our prisons. In Canada, you're over $6 billion to run your prisons. And the average cost is like $113,000 a year to keep someone locked up in prison. And with women, as we mentioned, it can fluctuate. And women, it fluctuates the cost of incarceration for them. Another thing that we noted, it was that in prisons, that prisons are considered sometimes by the devil's playpen. Because the devil gets in, and he does a lot, but God is still in control of the inmates on the inside. See, what happened was that Satan thought that he had them, and he tried his best to destroy them, but the prison became a saving place for these men. And they will tell you that the prison saved me. And if it had not been for the prison, I would be dead. Now, one of the ways that I know that God is still in control of the prisons, have you ever noticed that all of the tornadoes and all of the hurricanes that come through, have you ever heard of a tornado hitting a prison? And only once they had to be evacuated from Katrina down in New Orleans when a hurricane came through there. But God protects his children. And I remember in Nashville, a tornado came down the Cumberland River. Actually, it split into two tornadoes coming down the river, coming toward the prison. And it split. And it missed the prison. It went downtown Nashville and tore up downtown. But it just let me know that God refuses to allow Satan to destroy his children by inside of the prison like that, because even Jesus himself, his last ministry was on Calvary. That was prison ministry when he died between those two thieves. And as we said on yesterday, he was a chaplain on death row that ministered. So he has a natural affinity toward those who are incarcerated. And that's why he gave us the Great Commission in Matthew 25, is that he wants us to go inside of the prison and tell them about Jesus. And I'm glad that God has chosen you to do so. Now, every prison has its own personality. The strength of its subculture depends on the peculiarity of its personality. And prison subcultures make up the components of the prison world. And the subcultures in prison is like another city within the city. Everything that happens outside the prison happens on the inside of the prison. And you would be surprised at the things that go on. And if you think guys are not doing stuff on the inside of the prison, once they get there, that they're going to sit down and be quiet and be good little guys and good ladies, then that doesn't happen. Because guys are still busy doing the same kind of things that they were doing outside. So these are some of the things that you face in prison subculture. One, you have a code of ethics. This is the convict code. And it simply means mind your own business. If you mind your own business, you're probably not going to get hurt. If you snitch, you're going to get killed. We had one gentleman, everything that happened in the dorm, He ran to the warden and told the warden. And some of the guys got a hold of some spray paint, and they sprayed a big sign over his bed, CIA, Central Intelligence Agency. And so his life wasn't worth a plug nickel. They had to ship him from that institution to another institution. But that was one of the things in prison, is that you just don't go around snitching. And the convicts been there a long time. They feel like, this is my home. I'm going to be here. And if they have 1, 2, 3 life sentences, what do they have to lose if they wipe you out? Another life sentence not going to matter. I got 3 already, and I can't live but 1. And so the code of ethics is an important thing in the subcultures. Another thing that goes on in subcultures is con games. The guys can play some good games. We had one guy, this guy was so good that he could come in our office, in the chaplain's office, and he could steal stuff without looking at him. And he was a good con man. And I remember once he conned the lady and got her ring, $800 ring, off of her finger. And went down to the dorm and shaved off all of his beard and his hair to try to disguise himself. Another kind of con game that guys play, and I remember once this guy named Danny, I won't call his last name, but his father had been sickly, and Danny wanted to go on a 3-day pass so that he could be with his father. So In Department of Corrections in Tennessee, if your relative is critically ill and you don't expect him to live, then we can get a 3-day pass for them to go and to be with their relatives. So Danny worked at the Work Release Center, and at the work they say you can go out of the prison because you work downtown, you work for the state, and you have access to get to a payphone if you want to. So Danny got to the payphone and he called me and he said that, well, I'm Dr. So-and-so, I've forgotten the doctor's name, and Danny needs a pass to see his father because his father is critically ill, he's dying, and don't expect him to live. So can you arrange a pass for him to come out? And so I talked with Danny and I hung up the phone. And then I said, well, I'm going to call the doctor's office and see if this really is the doctor's office. When I called the doctor's office, the nurse said, no, the doctor never calls. And so it was a game that he was playing. So I just told his warden what he was trying to do, and the whole thing was nullified. But those are just minor games, con games. The guy's got 24 hours to think up stuff. So they can come up with some real good thing that they think are really foolproof. And I sit down and I would listen to them and how they would talk about how I'm going back out of prison and I'm going to do this and do this and I'm not going to ever get caught because I'm going to be far over this way and I'm going to let stuff go on over this way that I can be in control of. And so they would never be able to point back to me. And they get out of prison, and 3 months, they're back in prison and say, what happened to your scheme? You didn't con good enough. You didn't work it. But those things do happen as part of prison subculture. Another thing they go on in prison subculture, commissaries. And these are inmate stores. Now, prisons usually have a commissary where you can go and buy the things that you need, like sodas and cookies. And in the States, they have the guys got a little term, they call them Zuzus and Wham Whams, and those are cakes and cookies and so forth. And they can buy their deodorant, their cigarettes and lotion and so forth. Now, what inmates will do, they will have a commissary in their cell. And they would buy things and then they would sell them. Just for example, if they bought a can of soda for 50 cents, then they would charge a dollar for that can of soda. And the guys would purchase it. Sometimes they would sell chicken sandwiches, cheese sandwiches, bologna sandwiches. And you may ask, well, how do they get that? Well, they have friends who work in the cafeteria. And so the friends steal the chicken, they steal the bologna, the bread, and they get a cut. And the cut may not be anything but a couple of sandwiches. And so they sell those things out of their cell, and other things go on. So they are pretty, some of them are very good in entrepreneurship. They know how to hustle and make it on the inside. And of course, if the system found out what they're doing, they would try to disrupt it and stop it. Now, you might ask, well, how do they pay for it? Do they have money? Since prisons are supposed to be cashless economies, well, there is no way in the world to stop Canadian money from getting inside of the prison. There's no way in the world to stop American money from getting inside of the prison. It gets in. And the inmates have a lot of money sometimes. I have seen inmates with $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 in their pockets. We used to have a ball field at the Max. And the guys would go out and they would play poker every day. And that was a lot of money floating around in that prison. And that was at least $250,000 of green money at one time floating around in the Max. Guys had places where they go dig a hole and bury money. And the thing about it, we all could go, think we could find it. If we saw him go in around somewhere, we know he was going to dig a hole, that we could go around there and find that money. Well, we can't find it because the guys are so good at that. There was one guy who came to me one day. He had over $1,000 in his pocket. And I say, you know, you need to get that money out of here and send it to your folks. Because if security stops you, they're going to take the money. They're going to say that it's going in the general fund, but you know which fund it's going to. It's going in their pocket. So I've had to get guys to get money out of the prison like that. But I think one of the most interesting stories about guys having money inside the prison was this guy who was down in the cell who had built a telephone in his radio. And there were some wires that had been cut and that they weren't in use anymore, but they were still alive. So at night, he would hook the wires up from his radio, his phone in his radio, and he would call all over the country. And he did that for about 8 months. And they were getting big bills, but they didn't know where they were coming from. And so the only way that they caught him was somebody snitched on him. And when they went to his room, they shook down his room, the shakedown crew, and they found the telephone in his radio, and they found $10,000 in a shoebox in his cell. And how many of us have $10,000 around the house that we can just go and get? Yeah, you know, and not even a bank, not even in a 401k or no kind of K that we would have that much money. But those are kind of like, that's kind of like things that go on in a subculture. Money is there, and we'll talk about the drugs later because they're going to be there too. Loan sharks are some interesting guys. If they lend you a dollar, you have to pay back a dollar, dollar and a quarter, $1.50 on the dollar. So if you borrow a dollar, you pay back $2 or $2 and a quarter or $2 and a half. And if you don't pay the bill, then your life is not worth a plug nickel because they will kill you about that money. And we have loan sharks all over the prison. There are some guys that always have the money, and they know how to hide it to keep you from getting a hold of it. But the inmates know who has the money. And they're not going to snitch on the person, because that's part of their livelihood inside of the culture. And it's just like going to get a payday loan. And you got to pay the interest, but they know they can get it and still get it as long as they pay it back. Homosexuality is a biggie inside of prisons. We know that we in this era of gay liberation, pretty much, where it's just an acceptable part of society, and like it's almost like a norm to some people. But to us who know the Lord and believe totally in Christ, we know how what the Lord made. He made a man and he made a woman, and he didn't make anything other than that. But we have to just, you know, pretty much leave it at that, and we can hold to our values. They have a right to hold to their values and what they believe in. But we as Christians, we know what we need to adhere to. But homosexuality is a thing that went on in prison and goes on in all prisons. And it goes on not only with men, but it goes on with women. When I was at the women's prison, just about all of the ladies there thought that they need another lady to be their partner, and as a husband or a wife. And when we would go in, and we'd have to break up those relationships and move them from place to place, they would be so angry, because they tell the prison officials, "Now you're breaking up homes." And so when a lady comes in and to me and she says, "Chaplain, pray for me. I caught herpes from my partner, and will you pray that I be healed?" So I can pray for you and pray for your healing, but your behavior is going to have to change. It won't really matter if you're going to do the same thing over and over again. But that was a situation at the women's prison. At the men's prison, it was something going on all the time. We had four guys at the Work Release Center, and they had their pet names. One name was Sharon, one name was Lulu, Crystal, and Sunshine. And they cornered the market at that prison. And there was something going on all the time within. And the culture sometimes is such that guys who've been there a long time, when they see young guys coming into the prison, and the older convicts, when they see a young man getting off the bus, they call it the chain, and they say, "That's fresh meat. He's going to be mine." And they know how to play the games to get that person. For example, oops, I don't get enough of messing with this. For example, if a new guy comes in, there might be six or seven guys who will get around, and they'll try to say, you know, "He's going to be mine." They act like they're going to take over the guy. Then there'll be one guy, and stronger guy, will come in and break it all up, because it's already staged. Say, "No, come with me. I'll protect you." And he might tell the guy, "You know, you're just getting in. Do you smoke? Do you have any cigarettes?" He said, "No." "Well, here, take one of mine. You know, anything you need while you're here, just ask me. You need tennis shoes, anything." And so the guy thinks that he really got a good friend that's really going to be with him. And so he may call home and say, "You know, Mom, I met this real guy, a nice guy who's kind of showing me the ropes. He's going to help me to get through this." And maybe about 2 or 3 months down the road, this guy might say to him, "Say, hey, you remember that first cigarette that I gave you?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I want that same cigarette back. If you can't give me that same cigarette back, then you know what you got to do." And so that was just a game played way they might do in fostering homosexuality sometimes. But I've had to go out with guys who are gay and take them on shopping paths. And we'd be walking through Walmart and they would be trying to buy pumps and lingerie stuff. And of course, knowing that when they come through the gate, that security was going to take it. And so you're walking through and everybody's looking and you're saying, "Well, I hope they don't think that that's my partner," yeah. As you walk through. But then you can't even let your mind go there, because whatever you do for one, you got to do it for the other. And so their persuasion may be different, but they're still human. And they still have feelings and emotions, and however their feelings and emotions are, those are theirs. But I had a job and a commitment that I had to fulfill to everybody who was in the prison, regardless of who they are, what they believe. They could come in and they could be a pantheist, they could be a pagan, they could be anything that really don't represent our knowledge of the true God. And I had a guy who came in who was a pagan, but I had to make provision for the pagan so that he could practice his religion at the prison. And I'd gone through getting stuff that he needs and got it set up for him, found a sponsor to come in and work with him. And one day while he was working outside on the crew outside, he decided that he wanted to join the track team and become an Olympic sprinter. And so he took off running and escaped, and we didn't see him anymore. And so the Lord took care of that situation for me. I didn't have to deal with that one. And the same thing with a Native American Indian once. Had gone to the point of getting his grass and his pipe and getting it set up for his sweat lodge, and he got out one day and he took off running, so that ended that. And so I really didn't have to deal with anything else like that anymore all the time that I was a chaplain at the institution. Okay, gang rape is another thing that happens in prison. And if 8 guys around one guy, what is he going to do? It's going to be difficult. We had one young man who was raped by a gang of men from 12:30 at night to 5 in the morning. And a thing that really made me really, really angry was that a security officer opened the door so that the guys could get in his room. And they ended up having to take the kid out to the hospital, and he had to go through the surgical stuff of being sewed up, and that was just a bad experience. Gangs, there are a number of gangs throughout the prison, all kinds, you name them, they're there. Some of the roughest gangs that you'll find out in the California area. Then you have different kinds of gangs and all institutions. One prison that we have in Tennessee, they call it the Thunderdome. And at the Thunderdome, there are all kinds of gangs there, young guys, and they tangle, they fight, but there's no way to keep them out of the prison. They're going to be there. Who are you locking up? You're locking up gang members. When they come in, they keep their set going, whether it's Crips, Bloods, Black Gangster Disciples, or the Mexican gangs, the Latino gangs, the vice lords, or whatever, they'll continue to go. The drug culture is another culture that you find in prison subcultures. Drugs and drug dealers are on the side of the prison. The drug dealers are some very busy guys. They try to be incognito, but everybody know who they are. And you might wonder, you know, ask the question, how do they get drugs inside of the prison? Well, it's relatively simple that either it's going to be the staff, or it's going to be the family. And when someone come into prison, they can put drugs in a plastic bag, one of the real small ones, and they can insert it in any crevices of the body, and they can go in the bathroom once they get in, and they can take it out, and they can give it to the guys. We've had officers who have brought drugs in to the guys because they weren't getting paid enough. It was a way to make extra money and greed. And so they brought drugs in for the guys. Then sometimes they could take when they have boxes sent in, they could take a cardboard box. They could split the cardboard box and put cocaine down inside of it and then seal it back like it had not ever been cut. That was one way too that they could get drugs on the inside of the system. Sometimes they would even put it in the baby diapers to get it in. One gentleman, his mom was 62 years old, and he was having her to smuggle drugs in for him. And when they would go out in the picnic area, she would have the chest. She would have all the food and the ice, and underneath on the bottom under the ice on everything, she would have drugs sealed in a plastic bag. And so security found it, and they called Metro, and so Metro is Metro, the Metropolitan Police, and they came out and arrested her and took her to jail. So here was a man really didn't care anything about his mom, that he would put her at a disadvantage to smuggle drugs in. But that's how it is when people are on drugs. They don't care. All they want is the drugs, however they can get them. But inside of the prison, the drugs that are being used are the best kind of drugs that you can get a hold to. Now, you can't come into prison and give anybody any junk, because you'll probably get hurt. So they had the pure forms of drugs. Anything that you can name, marijuana, cocaine, heroin, all of it. And they have it on the inside. But that's, you know, one of the things that go on in the culture. Another thing here, there's no, and we kind of mentioned this, there's no facility within the Department of Correction where that will be immune from drugs. No matter what prison it is, you can get drugs in. In fact, they had drugs on death row. And you wonder, how in the world did they do that? If you go to a max unit, those that are down under the ground, where no supposed to be an inland Alcatraz, guess what? They have drugs on the inside of that prison. It was said that in the prison that you shouldn't be able to get a gun on the inside of the prison. But in the subculture world, there was a guy who had a gun on death row. One of the employees brought it into him piece by piece, and the inmate paid him $500 for bringing it in. Hacksaw blades. He brought him into an inmate. He sawed himself out of the jail cell, went in another cell, and killed another inmate. And of course, this young guy, he's smaller. He's probably as small as Saul back then. And he's one of the most dangerous guys in the system. He killed four guys while he was on death row. He stole a truck, ran through one set of barbed wire, and the only thing stopped it was the last roll of barbed wire that stopped the truck. But if he had gotten outside of the prison, it would have been holy terror, because he had no conscience at all. He's on death row. They had put him back on death row at one, because they go through so many appeals. The guys on death row, they have 6 or 7 appeals that they usually go through and exhaust all of their appeals before they get to the point of being executed. And it may take 20, 25, 30 years. There have been some guys on there 30 years. And the thing is that if a guy's on death row for 20 years, it costs us between $1.2 and $1.6 million to keep him locked up on death row for that long. Well, I think it would, you know, from my own personal experience, we could take at least 95-96% of the guys who are on death row and just put them out in population. And the general population is just that they'll be in the cells like regular guys. They won't be on death row. And they can be out working and so forth inside of the prison. And they will be fine. There are only a small percentage of guys that really do need to be on death row. But because of, you know, the courts and how the mandates, then they have to be on death row. But I think they could go in and commute these guys' sentences to life sentences without parole and let them stay out in the population. Okay, did that answer your question? Sort of? Right. Well, you know, we have a criminal justice system. Probably nowhere you go is this rotten. It need a major overhaul. A lot of it is political. People get elected to office because of their stand on certain issues of law and order and crime. And so they come up with all kinds of laws in which some of them really don't make a lot of sense. Like I shared with you yesterday, you know, a shoplifter having to be locked up for 5 or 10 years for stealing $1,000 worth of stuff out of Walmart. And all you need to do is make that person work and pay it back 10 or 15 times, and it'll hurt them more that way than it will. Because once you send them, it's like easy street for a lot of them, because they're going to get 3 meals, a place to stay, their lights and water bills are paid for, their medical bills are paid for. So it's easy street from that standpoint. So it was best to make them participate by paying for it. There are some guys who are institutionalized, and they feel like the prison is their home. We have had a guy who was there 24 years, and it came time for him to go home. The warden sent him out the gate, and it was a work release center, and there was no fence around it. So at night, he came back and he crawled back in his cell. And so the warden told him, "Look, you got to go home. You got to get out of here." He said, "I don't have nowhere to go. This is my home." And he had become so institutionalized. And there's several people who are institutionalized. They might go out and throw a rock through a window so they can get locked up again. And it's bad when you stay in so long. I think that when you stay in prisons so long, it's kind of like this way. You're going up, you reach your apex. If you turn the person loose at this point, this person probably will come down and live a good life and not do anything else. That's what some of the guys who've been in there really a long time. Well, they gonna have to ring. Okay, you hear it ringing on the tape. That's me. Yeah, just tell them I'm busy right now. So, I probably don't know what I'd say if I do that. But well, I call myself turning it down to the lowest point, but it's still ringing. But And so when y'all edit this tape, y'all please take this off the tape. I'm talking to the editors now who are going to edit this little thing. Inmates can really attain any kind of brand of alcohol that they want inside of prison. I've seen beer cans, Crown Royal, all kinds of stuff inside of prison. But what they really do in prison is that every system, they have some kind of brew that they make up by getting tomatoes and bread and sugar and cherries and all kinds of stuff out of the kitchen. And in our prisons in Tennessee, we call it julep. And it's kind of like them. Maybe you'd have to be down in the southern United States to know about homebrew. You know about homebrew?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So that's what the julep is kind of like. It's kind of like homebrew, kind of like a rot gut kind of alcohol. And they would make it, and then they would sell it. And I always tell the story about these guys who had made some homebrew, and there was a fire extinguisher on the wall in the dorm or the barrack. And what they did, they filled the fire extinguisher up full of julep. And all you had to do was go by and squeeze it and fill up your cup. But they were some smart guys. In fact, you got a lot of smart guys in prison. If they would take that and turn it into something positive, they'd be awesome. We had one guy who had stolen some cherries out of the kitchen, and they made 85% proof alcohol wine, and they were drunk that weekend at the prison. It was crazy. It took 9 security guards to take one guy up to the prison hospital. The warden would rather for guys to be on cocaine and marijuana and any kind of drug except for them getting a hold of alcohol. And you can pretty much understand that alcohol is a foolish drug. And when you drink it, and you drink enough of it, you become very foolish too. So that was kind of a bad weekend at the prison. As I was stating, you know, the warden, they would rather for the inmates to be high on drugs than that. We kind of mentioned some about the prisons being cash of the economies. The money sources. There are a lot of guys who probably would be the bank on prison, those who have access. We had this one guy named Colin Smokey, but Smokey always had a ton of money. He would always be lending guys money at the institution. And even Smokey was lending employees money. And that was a bad thing to be happening. But guys would borrow money and they wouldn't pay it back, and he would talk. And of course, that can cause you to lose your job. And there was no need for the guys to go and do that, because that was violating policy totally. And gambling, they do. Spending, they didn't mind spending. And the thing that they spent most of their money on was like tennis shoes. And I would walk around there, they'd have on $180 pair of Jordans. And all I could get was, $25, $19.95 from Kmart's and Walmart's. JCPenney's, that's all I could get a hold of. But that tennis shoes always look better than mine. There are other subcultural thing influences. Some inmates get caught up in this religiosity thing. Now, the thing that always threw up a red flag to me is that when I spoke to an inmate when he came over and he wants, you know, to be religious, and every time I see him, every word that comes out of his mouth is praise the Lord, amen. And you're saying that over and over and over, I throw up a red flag to me, because all I think you're just doing is putting on a show and trying to gain some favor some kind of way. Because if you live for Christ, your words don't have to be the thing that dictates. Your life tells whether you're living for Christ. And you don't even have to say a word sometimes, because I know you'd much rather see a sermon than to hear one. And so a lot of guys who did that, and we had one guy who he was just notorious for that. He got out of prison, started a business. Actually, he raised that business from just a vacuum cleaner in a buffet machine, starting out to $1 million plus janitorial business. Then he went into preaching, but he never stopped laundering drug money. And he finally got caught, and all the things that he had built up are now gone down the tube, and he's headed back to jail again. But he was one that would always, you know, just go overboard in expressing his religion. There are a lot of players inside, and a lot of players like to play on women. These guys, they have 24 hours to come up with a good rap, and they can say words to ladies that they never heard before. And they could, and they know how to prey on you. And many guys would prey on women, especially women who had a little bit more to love. They would have them bringing them all kinds of stuff. They would be neglecting their kids, buying food and so forth for these guys. When they get out, they abuse them, leave them, and so they wasted a lot of time and energy there. But you have to be careful, you know, about getting involved and with guys who are inside, especially in intimate relationships. Because all I've seen about marriages that happen inside the prison, and because there are a lot of marriages happen inside the prison, is, I don't know, in Canada, which football team up here fumbled the ball the most? Anybody know? Yeah, one in the football. One. Well, we had a team called the Oklahoma Sooners. And the Oklahoma Sooners, they had a powerful wishbone offense, but they fumbled the ball a lot. So it was a high-risk offense. So that's what marriage is inside the prison, is a high-risk offense. A lot of people get married, but they don't last. They drop the ball real soon. Phone junkies, and there are a whole bunch of them. That's why you should never give an inmate your phone number. Because every time you bat your eye, they would be calling, and they would just say, a collect call from the Edmonton Department of Corrections. Will you accept the call? And you accept the call, and you keep talking to them, and when you know anything, when they send your phone bill, it would say $900, $800, because every phone call, collect phone call, is expensive. And your phone will be off, and they'll just find another one that they can call. Guys have come into my office, and they've said, Chaplain, my mama got a block on her phone, and I can't call home. I need to talk to my mama. Yes, that's true, because you have called her so much that they had to turn her phone off, and she had to get a block put on there to keep you off of it so that she could have a phone. So I call them phone junkies, and for another reason is that guys, they know all of the people in the prison that they can go around to every day and try to get a phone call. So they would hit the chaplain, they would hit the OIC, they would hit the counselors, and every story that they told would be that I need to call home, or either something wrong with the children, or something wrong with their wife, or something wrong with their mom, or some other business venture. And so they knew how to frame it so that they would get a call. And they could stay on the phone in the cell for a long, long time. And sometimes they would be on the phone, they would get off the phone and go do something, and they still had the phone hanging down so nobody else could get on it. And another story I want to just share with you, and when you're talking about phone junkies, I remember this guy, his name was Robert. Robert could get a telephone book, and Robert could call numbers out of that phone book. He could bounce it off. He knew how to bounce it off the satellite, and he knew how maybe here and just say that he was in Bowdoin, okay, and if he wanted to call over to Toronto, he knew how to maybe bounce the call up in Anchorage, Alaska. He knew how to then send it down to Texas, and then maybe send it over to New York, and then call the number that he was trying to call. And so they couldn't trace it. He would open up phones on the ball field that would stay open for 3 or 4 days for you to make long distance calls on. And I would say that Robert, he was so smart that it was a shame that, you know, he had life sentence. And he might would have been out today, but a girlfriend came to see him when he was at work release, and he ran over her with the car. And not only did he run over one time, he backed back over again. And so he's not going to ever get out of prison. He'll be there for the duration. So the signs of gang involvement is wearing one particular color of clothing, maybe it's red, black, blue. They all have their colors. They have colors out of the Crips and the Blood. I think the Bloods are red, Black Gangster Disciples are blue and black. They got their own color. Oh, in the prison?
Yes.
Yeah, they still have their bandanas and so forth. They still have a way of identifying with colors. But they do have, as I said yesterday, they do have designer clothes inside of the prison. And they have, and what I mean by that is, in Canada, they may have Canada Department of Corrections. And that'd be maybe down the side of your pants, maybe across the back, your number. And everybody in prison is identified by a number. Your name is not important anymore. And that number will follow you. Okay, wearing sagging pants is another sign of gangs. Wearing jewelry with distinctive designs only on the right hand or the left hand of the body. Drawing gang symbols and using gang handwriting. Using hand signs to communicate. I had a set of gang signs that I didn't even think to bring Oliver. They're like the Black Gangster Disciples. They have ways. I mean, they might wiggle that jaw like that, and it's a breaker's jaw. And they have, you know, signs, you know, all kinds of signs that they use that give messages, and crossing their arms with one under like that, and you just have to kind of like know what they're talking about. And basically, all of us probably don't know what they're talking about. But they have ways of communicating. They have language that they use, and I think Oliver has some of the language that he's going to pass out to you, or if he didn't already. They defy authority. They use drugs and alcohol. They have behavior and performance problems. They have large quantities of unexplained cash. They possess unexplained cash for goods. They show signs of physical injury and lying about events surrounding the injury, hanging around friends who also exhibit these kinds of signs. Just a couple of the slangs that they use. A base head is called a person who's hooked on cocaine. Chiva is a person who's is heroin. A cluck is a cocaine smoker. Fry is marijuana laced with embalming fluid. And of course, then they have a Jimmy that don't have up there, but a Jimmy is one that's marijuana laced with cocaine. Knocking boots mean having sex. No diggity, as no doubt, without question, for sure. Tray 8 is a 38 caliber weapon. What up, dog, is one you probably hear a lot, a way of saying hi to your friend. And that's the end of that one. And Oliver, we get to one of the how-tos that we can probably do prior to how to communicate with inmates that we can get to. And it's one of the things when you go inside of the prison, it's so important to know how to communicate with guys, because you're going to be different, dealing with a different clientele. Although they're different, they're still human. But there are certain things that you need to be able to know, because you're going into a different setting, and they want you to feel comfortable when you go in. That's good. Thank you, sir. How to work with inmates. Don't carry items into the prison, especially letters. Don't carry letters inside the prison. Now, there's a reason why you shouldn't carry letters inside the prison, why you shouldn't bring any out. Because an inmate can come up to you and give you any excuse to take a letter. And it can sound very convincing. And the letter may just be saying that these some important papers that my mom need, if I send it out in the mail, it's going to be a couple of weeks before she get it. And he may tell you, you know, if it's a life and death matter, and if she doesn't get these, it's possible that she may, die, or it's possible she may be put out of her apartment, lose her home. But the danger you face is that you don't know what's in that letter. It could be cocaine. And they could already have set you up. And when you get to the gate, the security officer will shake you down, go through the letter, find the cocaine, and then what you think happens? That's right. You're the one that gets arrested, and you'll be the one that's going to jail. No money is to be exchanged, given, or received. No matter how grave the story is, don't take any money out for them, even if they tell you that my mom is on a respirator and they're about to turn the lights off, the electricity. And if she doesn't get this money, then she'll end up dying, because there'll be no power to run the respirator. Even if they say that, don't take any. Take that, because if the mom is on a respirator, there is indigent care, and she can't get to the hospital, and they will take care from that standpoint. But I had a cousin once that was locked up in the prison, and he tried his best to give me some money to take to his mama, and I told him I couldn't do it, And actually, he got angry with me, and he didn't say a whole lot to me after that point. But it didn't matter. I knew what I could do and what I could do. And the thing about working inside a correction, if you follow policy, you will be okay. It's only when you violate policy that you will be in trouble. So as long as you obey the volunteer rules and follow policy, you're going to be fine. No phone calls for inmates without consulting with the chaplain. They may tell you that they need you to call somebody, but if they need to call somebody, if it's urgent, that's what we're there for. We're there to take care of their needs. So don't let them trick you into that. Now, it may be a case where you might go in and it may be somebody that you know. It may be a close friend's son. You have the liberty of saying whatever you want to your close friend. But I'm just saying, don't ever, let them coerce you or entice you to make phone calls for them. No medicine is to be brought into the prison. And so any medication that you're on, make sure that you take it prior to going to the prison. Going in. If there's something you feel like you're going to need to take, you can all, I think most places you have lockers.
Yes.
That you can just lock it up, and if you had to come back out and take it, then it'd be much safer for you to do that. Because once you go inside of the prison and they shake you down and you have pills on you, and they could say that you were trying to supply inmates with pills. And so you don't ever want to get in that predicament. So it's better to stay above board, and you don't have to deal with it. No proselyting. We just kind of mentioned that yesterday. Proselyting means steep shielding.
Sheep stealing.
Sheep stealing.
Sheep stealing.
Yeah, I mean, I said something else at first. But, and that's simply saying that if you're going in as an Adventist doing worship service, and there are Baptists and Catholics and Presbyterians and Methodists, and you tell the inmates, hey, look, they don't have the truth. You need to come over here with us. And so you're trying to steal them away from the other denominations. And so that's one thing that we as volunteers would never want to do, because then what it does, it put our volunteer program in jeopardy. Some chaplains don't like us anyway. And they would find any excuse to get us out of there. And that would be a good excuse for them to put you out. And one of the things about prison, if that is you get blackballed at one prison, you're blackballed at all of them. Because they're going to spread the word. Don't let this group in. They're just troublemakers. And when you don't want it to be said that when they see you coming, oh, here come these troublemakers, these Adventists are troublemakers. You don't want that stigma on you. So just never proselyte, because most of the guys, they're going to be going from service to service anyway. If you got a good program and something that's really good and enticing, guess what? They're going to come to you anyway. Okay? Always be yourself. In other words, what we said, don't be a phony. Be genuine. Because inmates know all about being phony. And I told you yesterday they can spot a phony 50 miles out before you even get there. They know because they played the game. So just, be yourself. God has given you special gifts, special talents. Just be yourself. Let your warm personality come flowing through. And it would be contagious. They know that you are a good person. And they can tell when people are good. Be guided by impulse. And basically I'm saying be guided by the Holy Spirit. Let the Holy Spirit guide you in all that you do inside of the prison. be honest, frank, and fair. Inmates really don't care whether you know about things. As long as you're honest, as long as you're fair, they don't care. I mean, you can be frank with them, but if you're honest and fair, they really appreciate that more than anything else. Don't accept everything the inmates say as the gospel. They have a good grapevine. They do a lot of propaganda at times. And you know, it always has been my contention that the only organization that has a better grapevine than prison inmates is the Seventh-day Adventists. And because, you know, I always say television, telephone, tele-Adventist. And it'll get around the world before you can get your boots on. So, you know, they say a lot of stuff, the inmates do. And so they knew a lot of things that were going on, and they were spreading a lot of things that were going to come down before we even knew it as workers sometime. And I don't know how they got a hold of a lot of stuff. Go easy on discussing cases. Never ask an inmate, what are you in for? If you work with that inmate long enough and he feel comfortable, he's going to tell you what he's in for. Let him tell you.
Yeah.
But don't ask him what you're in for. And if he try to get you bogged down in his case and say, you know, and pull you into it, well, we have law clerks, we have jailhouse lawyers, and we have jailhouse lawyers in corrections who were better lawyers than Johnny Cochran. We got in prison, you had the best law books. They all have to be up to date on all of the latest briefs. Have to be there, and they have law clerks whose full-time job is to research and help other inmates with briefs to file in court. And the lawyers, jailhouse lawyers, I mean, they go in and they do a pretty decent job. Now, some of them have gotten their cases, their sentences reduced. Some of them have helped people to really get out of the system. But I'm saying that only to say to you that don't let them sucker you into getting involved in their case. That's the reason that you can, you know, refer. And you can refer him to your group leader, mm-hmm. and let your group leader tell the chaplain. So, because what's going to be your liaison is going to be your group leader. He's going to be your liaison from the group to the chaplain. And the chaplain's going to be your liaison to the administration. And then you follow the protocol like that, and they'll make sure that it gets done. Be open for growth and development. While you're doing prison ministry, make sure that you learn, okay? Avoid selling anything. And if you have any doubts about anything, ask. It is no crime to ask, but it may be a crime if you don't ask. So make sure you do that. Okay, so are there any questions? We'll take up on the other, some more how-tos tomorrow and how to help a scary church to do prison ministry. Okay, that's correct. Definitely. She was saying that you abide by the regulations. It's just common sense. And if you do that, you'll stay out of trouble. And that's so essential. And see, you got a younger population in prison.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They have their own language. And it's so important to understand cultures and languages. And so that we don't walk around in darkness. So it's all of these languages and slang is so important, especially if you're going to work in prison ministry. that you do need to be aware. I mean, it's not something that you have to speak, but something that you just need to be aware of what's going on. And when you're forearmed, it's like you got your armor on.